Good evening and welcome to tonight's program of the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. I'm Ann Clark, a member of the Commonwealth Club and chair of the Environment and Natural Resources member-led forum. Our program is also sponsored by the Business and Leadership member-led forum, Kevin O'Malley Chair. And the August programs this summer are sponsored by Ernst & Young, who is sponsoring all of our programs. Our program tonight is the Big Book of In Your Face Gay Etiquette with Daniel Curzon, well-known author, teacher, and the first person, and I know this for a fact because I knew Daniel when this happened, to legally, publicly, and courageously challenge electronic cyber gay bullying. And that was during the beginning of cyberbullying, which has become more and more prevalent across the United States in all areas. But Daniel was there in the worst of times when there was no one to defend it or to defend him in 2000. The sad part about this is that Daniel did go to court. He did go legally to challenge what was happening. And I think for myself, the biggest disappointment was that he lost. And he lost to the ACLU, who was against what you were saying. And what's sad about that to me is that I always think of the ACLU as a very tolerant group in many ways, but their stand was on freedom of speech. And to this day, I think we are suffering in many, many parts of our population groups across the nation and among our children, by the fact that cyberbullying has really gotten more and more extensive. So if Daniel had succeeded, I think the world might be just a little bit better, but he went through some very, very difficult times in 2000, 1999 and 2000. So it's a great pleasure and honor for me to welcome our friend and my friend, Daniel Curzon.
How's the voice level? Okay. Okay. I apologize for anything I'm going to say. That seems to be the order of the day. You say something and then immediately you have to apologize for it. So I'll get it out of the way ahead of time. Okay. I'd like to tell you tonight, thank you for coming. What the hell getting here? What a parking problem. I'm turning into an old fart before your very eyes. I'd like to tell you about my journey as a gay man from youth to middle age to old age and how it dovetails with the gay movement. I haven't really thought how much my life actually coincides with many things in the gay movement until I did the notes for this talk. Unlike many who speak out about gay issues, I am an expert. I have done much research in the field. If you catch my drift. And it wasn't easy getting there. Does it sound awful like I'm, there's an echo? It's okay, all right. Other people in this building have spoken recently about gay issues. I think of Rick Perry. I don't know if he was in this room or not, but he was nearby. And he was, you know, there are all these people like Rick Perry and Rick Santorum and Ralph Reed pontificating about gay issues and gay sex. Where's the proof that they know anything about gay sex? I want photographs. I want dates. I want lists. I've written enough of my own. All right. They have no no homosexual credentials whatsoever to speak of. Believe me, they've been earned in my case. You want to know what the gay agenda is? Get off our backs. That's the whole gay agenda, especially since you don't like gay sex. Get off our backs. all right. Let me start with my youth. I was born near Farmersville, Illinois. Actually at Litchfield, which is 15 miles down the road on Highway 66, in America's heartland. Can't be more wholesome all-American than Farmersville, Illinois. My mother had gone to the fourth grade in Tennessee, down the hills, the hollers of Tennessee. She could barely read. My father went to the seventh grade in Illinois, in the farmlands of Illinois. He could read a little better than my mother. Both of them disliked books. They discouraged me from reading, believe it or not. But I was a willful, and actually I was a very compliant child. Anyway, we moved to Detroit when I was 3 years old because World War II was getting underway, and Detroit was livable then. If you've been to Detroit lately, it's not very livable. It's actually a wasteland. And both the houses I lived in are no more in this vast weed scrub blowing through the city of Detroit. Now, in Detroit, I had a very misguided life. I was Catholic. That's why I had a misguided life. Everything was about sin. Sin, 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 especially sexual sins. Guilt, 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 guilt. No touching yourself. So I was a good Catholic boy. I didn't touch myself. I didn't even know what they meant by that. And I never touched myself till I was 21 years old. People don't believe me, but I'm telling you, why would I lie? Then I touched myself one time. I thought, oh, that's what they're talking about. That. I still was so inundated by Catholic theology and homophobic attitudes that I didn't have sex till I was 26 years old. I've made up for it, I must have to say, since then. I still have not forgiven the Catholic Church. I don't think I will ever forgive the Catholic Church. And to the new Pope, who's supposedly all so liberal and forgiving, and I say, man does not live by breadcrumbs alone. Gay sex at 26, my first arrest at 29. I was arrested by a plainclothes vice squad officer in Detroit. Now, maybe I shouldn't have been out in the park in the dark where no one else was around except other gay men. But I know for sure the police shouldn't have been there entrapping gay men dressed like gay men. This was an eye-opening experience. This was a radical experience in my life. It made me aware that it was them that was the problem, not me. They're the problem. I'm a good person, so I had sex outside. Big deal. Shouldn't ruin your life. What are they talking about? It's, the punishment far exceeded the crime. So I started writing. The only thing I knew what to do was to write. So I started writing a gay protest novel, which I called from the beginning Something You Do in the Dark, which was published, glory be, by G.P. Putnam in 1971. Yay, this was the happiest day of my life. It was October 1st, 1970, when I got a letter in England. I was living in England, and my New York agent sent me a letter saying Putnam was going to publish my book. It's still the happiest day of my life. My book, Something You Do in the Dark, was published the same week as The Exorcist, which I think did a little better, just a little better than my book. It was the first gay protest novel. I don't care what Wikipedia says. Wikipedia keeps cutting out that fact. I've had several scholars put it in that it was the first gay protest novel, And they keep cutting it out, saying, no, there's no proof of this. Well, I have, someone sent me the press release from the first edition from Putnam, and it says, breakthrough novel, a new way of thinking, a condemnation of oppression, and blah, if that wasn't the first gay protest novel, I don't know what it was. And no one has pointed out any other gay first protest novel that I know about. I wrote all of this book in Asia, on U.S. military bases in Vietnam, Okinawa, and so on, Japan. In those days, in case you don't know, you could be fired immediately for being gay. Not even for doing anything gay, just for being gay. And I was a civilian employee for the University of Maryland. I was not actually in the military, but the same rules applied to me. And in fact, the third year of my teaching there in Asia, I was put on trial by the English department and the faculty because I had tried to teach something gay to the U.S. military by handing in some sheets of paper from a book I was writing to the education office. This was, believe me, faxing was brand new about 1973. It's hard for older or younger people to realize that, but you couldn't get a fax phrase that I had to give. I wouldn't have risked it otherwise. But I handed in this manuscript, and the guy saw something gay, and he turned me in. And I was fired, or I would have been fired. I had signed my contract already. And then there was a big trial with about all the faculty members talking about whether I should be fired or not because I had taught something gay. You could teach something about women, about blacks, about any other group. You couldn't teach anything about gays. It was maddening. Fortunately, I realized that I had to do something. I applied for a job at Fresno State. And lo and behold, out of 225 people, I got the job for a one-year job at Fresno State. In fact, it was so different there that I was asked if I would like to teach a gay studies class, a gay literature class, in 1975. And I said, if Fresno is ready, I'm certainly ready. And believe it or not, we got 10 people to enroll. In 1975, people were not ready to put their name on something called gay literature on their transcript. God help them. So we got 10 brave souls who signed up and taught the class. I believe I was the first openly gay teacher at Fresno State, 1974. And why do I keep emphasizing the first thing? Because I think pioneers sometimes don't get the credit that they so desperately want. They went through all this crap, and they don't want someone else to come along and later on say, oh, I came out on television in 1997, and now I'm hosting the Academy Awards. Well, lucky you. Some of us don't really sweat it through this. Made it hard to get through. Okay. In 1976, I moved to the promised land, San Francisco, California. And at last, sex, all kinds of sex. It was great, but be careful what you pray for and get sometimes, right? And in San Francisco in 1982, I wrote a gay etiquette book. Again, I believe this is the first gay etiquette book. The one that I have now, right now is an update, a third edition of the same thing. It was first called the Big Blue Book of Big Blue Book of Gracious Gay Etiquette. And it was supposed to be a spoof. It's not really advice on how to handle gay things, except incidentally. It's more of a social commentary and a mockery of Amy Vanderbilt and Emily Post and things like that. Except I was talking about, you know, masturbation, proper masturbation, and other things like that, which I thought would be a hoot. This is, in a fun. And sex can be funny. Sex should be funny, I think. Okay, let me read you a little section from the etiquette book. This was in the original 1982 edition. This is about how to tell if it's the real thing. It's mostly for two men, for gay men to know if they have the right partner or not. It looks, feels, and tastes like love, but is it? Answer yes or no to the following and find out. You wouldn't want to make any mistakes in the crucial part of your life, would you? 10 yeses and it's the real thing. Less than 10, keep on trying. Number one, you don't mind his penis tattoo. Number two, you don't mind talking about his ex-lover. Number three, you had one evening out and two meals together without sex of any kind. Number four, you have memberships in the same gym, which neither uses. Number five, you didn't rim on the first date. That's so 80s. Number six, he didn't give you anything except attention. Number seven, you didn't write your name and telephone number on a scrap of paper. You used a full sheet. Number eight, the sex wasn't that fantastic, but you remembered his name. Number nine, he said he'd like to see you again and actually called. Number 10, oddly enough, he's not your type. Number 11, you didn't want to go out and have sex right after he left. Number 12, you feel easy and uneasy, apprehensive, happy and unhappy, clean and valuable. 13, 20 years have gone by and you still haven't kicked him out. That's how you know it's the real thing. Okay. Let me read a couple other new things. I've already updated the gay etiquette book. Things you shouldn't say. This is for my tax man. I wrote these in England. I just came back from England. I couldn't have possibly have gone to England and written these things, could I? Without a tax break. Five, there's some things that you should never say at a gay wedding. Number one, it was a lovely ceremony. Too bad both of you are going to burn in hell for all eternity. Number two, I didn't want to come, but my wife, Edith, had already bought the toaster. Number three, congratulations on your marriage. I give it 2 weeks. Which one of you is the woman and which is the man? You may find that such easy role-playing among gays is not as common as you may think. You may also be asked, who is the wife or husband in your relationship? And you might be more hard-pressed to answer than you like. Number five, the Ayatollah sends his regrets. The gay couple may take this to mean that the Ayatollah regrets the gay wedding, but if the guest says that a fatwa containing a death sentence will follow, it will be clear what is meant, and at least the gay couple can be pleased that they will get a gift from the Ayatollah. Never ask a gay couple what they're going to do on their honeymoon. You may get more detail than you are prepared for. Here's some things gays shouldn't say at a gay wedding. Gay men and lesbians should never refer to their partner as my comfort woman. It shows a poor sense of history. After appearing at City Hall and proclaiming your eternal gay love, don't say at the wedding reception, okay, now I want to have a life even more like straight people. I want a divorce. Here's Here's another one I just wrote recently. It's called Love Butts. B-U-T-S. No. Love Butts. It's about love, but. Okay. You've been together for over 30 years. Yay! But your partner is crazy. Mine's not here tonight. You'd like to have an open relationship at last, but you can't get it up anymore. You used to hope that he would settle down once he reached a certain age. He has reached that certain age and beyond, and he wants to leave you for a pimply blonde half your age. You thought it was forever, but it just seems like forever. You got married at City Hall, you got married on television, but you got divorced in secret 3 weeks later. There should be legalized gay marriage everywhere, but they should outlaw gay divorce. It takes two to make a quarrel. No, it takes just one. Love is that special something that says, I couldn't find anybody else. You don't choose your sexual orientation. You don't choose who you find sexy within that orientation, but you can choose between your protective depends brand shields or guards, depending on whether you leak a little or are a man with larger surges. All right.
This is Ann Clark, and you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California Radio and our program, The Big Book of In-Your-Face Gay Etiquette, with Daniel Curzone.
We've come a long way since I wrote that etiquette book, since I wrote Something You Do in the Dark. Unless you live in 37 countries in Africa, much of the Middle East, Eastern Europe, Russia, Mississippi, you're hanging around Michelle Bachmann and Mike Huckabee. The gay journey has not been all triumph after triumph. You know, we read the news and the state allows gay marriage and that state allows gay marriage and so on. But I feel like we're still never more than 5 seconds away from a homophobic remark or a law, and you cannot always count on winning. We mustn't forget the dark side of our past, I think. I don't want to think about AIDS too much because it was so horrible going through that in the 80s and 90s, and still not gone. But you don't see as many people, at least I don't see as many people, who are obviously, you know, covered with lesions and so on. And I must say, where I go now, I see gay men having unprotected anal sex. And I think they shouldn't do that. They've forgotten. They don't know. I mean, I had several close friends. Dan Turner was one of my friends. We wrote musicals together. And he was an incredibly handsome man who was one of the first diagnosed in 1981. And then, you know, his body began to decay, and he went crazy. He was demented. He was running around his house carrying fire and giving a dinner party and tripping over the cords. And it was just incredibly horrible. Rodney Price was another one. He was in The Angels of Light. I wrote a musical with him called Cinderella Too. And then, you know, he winds up, you know, with lesions on his body. He's tap dancing in his wheelchair. And it was incredibly sad, catastrophic. And I don't think people should forget that. And, you know, sometimes, you know, we don't want to have gay men, you know, committing suicide anymore. We don't want to talk about that. But I know some people who have committed suicide. And you shouldn't take that away from human beings, from gay people in particular, just because it's not something you're supposed to do or we're driven to do that anymore. But it's a fact of life that some people do that. We mustn't forget the dark side of life. Not just, you know, gays as silly queens and, you know, silly even gay etiquette books. I like, you know, having fun and so on. But sometimes it becomes, you're not consequential. You're not consequential people. We are consequential people. We feel pain. That's the main reason I wrote Something to Do in the Dark. I wanted people to feel my pain. I wasn't just a silly throwaway nothing. It didn't matter. And there's always a danger of that, I think. It's lurking there. Okay, we come now to old age. You know, I was going to say, I wouldn't wish AIDS on anybody, not even Rick Santorum and the Westboro Baptist Church. Maybe on the Westboro Baptist Church. We come to old age. I am 76 years old as I stand before you today. I don't feel a day over 75. The gay movement, by the way, started before Stonewall. People always think, you know, Americans have a very poor sense of history, it seems to me. And when it comes to gay, the gay history, I think they have a very poor sense of history, too. I never heard of Stonewall when I wrote Something to Do in the Dark. I just thought I was a good person. And the world was treating me badly, and I should scream about it, yell about it, dramatize what was happening, vice squad raids and things like that. The gay movement is getting up there in age, too, and we're winning. But there's also a lot of political correctness, not just in the gay movement, but in the United States in general, and I find it extremely tiresome. And that's why I wrote Halfway to the Stars, Cable Car Tales of a Grumpy Gripman, which takes place very close to this building, actually. You know, it takes place on the cable car. You know, Gripman is a man who drives the cable cars. And my Gripman is funny, but he's an old fart, and he's not happy with what he sees on a daily basis. And in San Francisco, I feel you can only be liberal. You can never have a day when you have another thought. I don't know if you feel that way or not, but if you do, I think you would like this book. I notice when I tell people that, I say, oh, blah, 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 blah. And then they say, well, secretly, I know, blah, 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 blah. And they look around like, you know, the Gestapo is after them. Now, it's different in other parts of the world. I realize that if you're in, you know, an African country, you have a different problem. But in San Francisco, it's just so politically correct. And all these factions fighting with each other. It's like the Sunnis and the Shias, only more vicious. You have to get the right terms for transsexuals and trans this and not use that term. And this, it makes, you know, the questioning is the one I particularly find. You know, it's, get them right now. It's gay, lesbian, bisexual, did I leave anybody out? Transsexual, questioning, had a gay sex experience once, didn't like it, thought about having sex, on and on and on. It comes from a good place. You don't want to hurt anyone's feelings. But sometimes it becomes a kind of Puritanism. I'm more holy than thou, and I'm the arbiter of what's holy. What did you say just now? How dare you say that? That's not the term. We just made up a new term. And you're behind the times. Anyway, I think most people are not all liberal or all conservative. I think that's an artificial distinction. I think we all have days and moments within days when we're a little of one or the other. Some people are more obviously that San Francisco is the epicenter of liberalism. That's fine. I'm mostly liberal myself. But there are days when, Tuesdays and Thursdays, when I have some Republican thoughts. I confess. When I go downtown in San Francisco, besides all this construction, there's also a lot of homelessness and creepy people. I'm sorry. Did I offend someone by saying someone was creepy? I find there's people, you know, panhandling me with a, you know, carrying a cup, a tin cup with a quarter in it behind me saying, you know, rattling and saying, it could be a gun. It could be a gun. I better give him some money or he'll shoot me. So excuse me if I read a little bit from this book, where he says some things. I'm not going to read the most offensive parts because this is a group setting and people. I make this distinction. I think in the theater you're asking, and this is like a theater, you're asking for agreement and applause and let's all be feel happy together and so on. But with a book, it's like, can I talk to you privately? I want to say a few things that I wouldn't say out loud to other people. You say, really? What is that? All right, so this is page 169. Oh, I made the narrator of my book a bisexual. That's the minority that's forgotten. The forgotten minority. He says he has a girlfriend named Darlene. I have been told that Darlene is still in her coma, resting comfortably, out of intensive care. I will go see her any day now. It's hard enough talking to her when she's awake, never mind in a coma. I bet if I started talking to her, she'd start flailing about and do herself some real damage, or me. Just when I thought things might have settled down into a routine so that I could rest my frazzled brain, I do worry about Darlene. I do care about her. Somebody goes and leaves a big turd on my cable car. It was on the floor under a seat in the middle. I picked it up and put it in a plastic bag. I figured that it was a dog turd, but then when I looked at it more carefully, I was sure it was a human one. Now, who would shit on a cable car? I ask you. I don't think, well, there's another character. I'll skip that part. I tried to jump off several times when we were stopped to throw it into a garbage can along the route, although you are supposed to separate your compost from your paper items, as if I had time to get the shit just so. But there was a cop on one corner and a shop owner on the next, neither looking forgiving for any compost infringement. So I held onto the bag. Biddy the second, his pet rat, under my arm, could smell it and sniff curiously. I pushed his head back and told him to go to sleep. My mind turned to rumination on just how that human turd got to where it was on my cable car at 10:33 a.m. Thursday on an early spring day. Was somebody refused the use of a restaurant's restroom? It happens a lot, actually. Was that turd a political statement? Let my people shit. Maybe the outdoor public toilet down the hill wasn't working as usual. The homeless sleep in it, drug addicts shoot up in it, tourists are shocked by it, and nobody seems to take care of it. We Muni employees have keys to special Johns here and there throughout the city, so it wasn't one of us. Though I wouldn't put it past Mary Lou Luton, one of the Muni inspectors. She's full of shit. Then I thought perhaps it was from somebody from a foreign country. Yeah, call me xenophobic, all you like. The fact is, in some places, people shit in a hole right in the ground. They don't even sit on a toilet. Shitting is shitting, I suppose, but squatting over a hole? Would you make your grandmother shit over a hole? What about her old creaky legs, to say nothing about the lack of dignity? It could have been a little kid who left the turd. Lost control, the mother didn't see it, and suddenly there was. Well, why wasn't she watching better? Why didn't the mother pick it up? Was it that mean little ghost boy that I saw on the cable car earlier, the one that pushes people off? Boo. No, it was a teenager. Teenagers will do anything. He was probably on a dare from his buddies. Bryce is too chicken to shit on a cable car. Nanny, nanny, nanny. I'll show you can shit on a cable car, Bryce bragged. And he did it with his buddies sheltering him from view. Then they all laughed until they almost fainted and ran off and did something else obnoxious. Am I beginning to sound like my cranky dead Aunt Mildred? Was it the lurking tourist whom we saw when he saw the two gay guys French kissing on the cable car? Or me getting a blowjob? That's another scene. The blue and red gangs popped one out of their pants in the excitement and the shootout on the cable car. Nobody saw it until just now. What color was that turd, red or blue? Maybe old Athena dozed off and dropped it and didn't even notice. Is my time for dropping turds coming too? Then I realized the truth, God Almighty, had placed the turd there under the seat as a test, of course. Aunt Mildred was always saying that God Almighty is testing me. Usually she was referring to something her least favorite nephew, me, had done, like smoking weed in the tall grass behind her house in Stockton. But if Almighty God could take the time out of his busy schedule to test my Aunt Mildred, then he certainly could take time out to test me, too. And I survived that test. I saw a green plastic garbage can labeled for compost at the top of Knob Hill, and glory be if I didn't toss that turd into that bin and slam the lid shut on it. In my mind, that turd was no more. I hadn't had let me get it down for more than a few minutes, and my life went on. That's how you have to deal with all this shit life brings you. Thank you, God. Okay. I just want to conclude with a couple of things, a couple of bits of advice. Find humor in life whenever you can. The world is actually a pretty dark place, I think. And second, despite what you may have heard, to the contrary, I have always found cocksuckers to be very nice people.
This is Ann Clark, and you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California Radio and our program, The Big Book of In-Your-Face Gay Etiquette with Daniel Cursone. We've come to that time in our program where we're open for audience questions. I think what we're going to have to do is have you speak into this microphone, give it to me, I'll run up and give it to you. And who's our first question?
When you were arrested the first time in Detroit, you said that the punishment didn't match the deed, so I'm sorry you had bad sex, but anyway, what was the punishment?
I went to jail for 30 years. No, I didn't. After that long pause, I thought I had to make something dramatic. I was on probation. And I had to go. I had to call the public defender about 50 times. And my parents were living with me. This was 1967, and I was afraid that they would find out that I had been arrested. I was friends with Joyce Carol Oates then, name drop, and I was afraid she would find out, and it would be the end of my life. So I actually didn't go to jail. I had the character in the novel go to jail. And then something happens in jail. But I actually just was on probation for about a year. And finally, I found out there was a program where you could have a record expunged if you went down there enough times and you filed the paperwork. So I got my record back one day, and I took a cigarette lighter and I burned it, and I went across to Windsor where there was a gay baths, to the gay baths, and had gay sex. That was my revenge.
Second person.
Hello, Dan. I was 19 in 1974 or 75, and I remember vividly reading Something They Do in the Dark. And that's the title, yeah? I got it right. Yeah, Something You Do in the Dark. And I'm so glad you described it this way, because what I remember so distinctly was the feeling, the first time in my life, the vivid realization, oh, there's something wrong with them, not something wrong with me. I'll never forget that, and I want to thank you for that. And you also said that you wrote it because nobody else had written a novel like that, a gay protest novel. And I'm wondering, looking at what's called gay literature today, what is the novel that nobody has written?
This one is one no one is reading. I don't know if there's a novel that hasn't been written. I do think people are not reading very much, including me. And the gay bookstores have gone from what, 30 or so to maybe one or two? There are sections of gay books in other departments and other stores, I understand. But I have a feeling that we're so mainstreamed now. And there isn't a television program that doesn't have a gay character or a gay sequence or something gay about it. So it's not as forbidden and hard to get as it used to be. And I think that's part of the problem. That I don't think, there may be people writing novels right now that I don't know about. And to be honest, I'm sort of competitive with other gay writers. It's the truth. So I don't go out of my way to read all the latest gay things. I actually prefer nonfiction. I don't know.
The question is.
Well, he said he doesn't know, but I'll say it, I'll repeat it. You wrote the novel Something You Do in the Dark because it was a novel that needed to be written. I'm saying, in your reading, or even without knowing what's been written, what is the novel? What's the subject matter and the theme of the novel that you would like to read now that you haven't seen anybody write? Whether it's gay or otherwise.
Was that recorded, or why are we repeating it? Okay. Well, I do think what I said about political correctness is the novel that needs to be written. I think people are too mealy-mouthed about lots of subjects. I don't think they talk enough about homophobia among minority groups. There's one. Among blacks, Hispanics, even Asians. I think that's a subject matter that needs to be explored and brought out, talked about. And I have, and I will.
I have a two-part question. What were your feelings on the word queer going away? And if would it be bad etiquette if I suck and swallow a guy and ask for cab fare?
You ask for whatever you can get. Yeah, I've had that happen to me. God, I still look pretty good for 76. I don't want to pay. We all pay, by the way. Even if you have a long-term lover like I do for 34 years, you pay. He's not here tonight. He's home with a sty in his eye, and I nursed him all day and so on. You pay for having a lover. If it's not money, you pay some other way. And the other one was about the word queer. I'm old enough not to like the word queer. You know, when I see something like queer studies, my hackles go up. I know it's been reclaimed and all. I know all the things you're supposed to say about it. It's just something people yell from a car for me. And they're not talking about queer studies.
Another audience question? We're somewhat of a quiet group, kind of together with one microphone. So, Daniel, I'd like to ask you, for all your years in education, what do you remember most vividly, and what changes have you seen for good or evil, or good or bad?
In education? Well, I'm a real Nazi when it comes to education. I'm sorry. I have really strong feelings about discipline, and I think the American school system is totally undisciplined. Someone in the room who I won't name tells me his experiences teaching in high school. I went to a retirement party recently. He was teaching in someone else was teaching in Richmond, California. I said, how was that? And he said, well, I spent 80% of my time on discipline. And I think all liberals should be thrown alive into an American high school. And I don't think you'd be as liberal. And this goes back to my teaching a ninth grade class many, many years ago, my first teaching experience. But I also visited classes. And the students are rude. They're mean. They think the teacher is supposed to be a warden or a police officer. You're not supposed to be a police officer. And someone who's the least bit nuanced can't get a job as a teacher. And so you become a security guard. And they think it's their job, the students think it's their job to be nasty to you. And if you're a substitute teacher, God help you. You're lucky just to keep the kids in their seats. Not much education is going on. And then I, as a college teacher, inherit these students who are not prepared, who can't read frequently, can't write. They don't usually misbehave in the classroom, although some of that was creeping up by the time I retired 7 years ago. How dare you? How dare you? That's what I think is wrong with American education. So I'm an old fart about that particular topic. You know, Robin Williams died. And, you know, he was a genius. But I didn't like the Dead Poet Society because he taught students to stand on their desks. They don't need to be taught to stand on their desk. They need to make the subject agree with the verb.
Any other thoughts from the audience at the moment? Well, I have one more question. And I'm holding the microphone. So we've come from 2000, when you filed your action, to 2014. And when I think of that, I think of what really happened in 2000 to you as an action of that times in a way, but also as an action that continues in the fact that we really do have people who were able to access the electronic media at that time who didn't even know you, had never been your students. This was a teacher-student evaluation who wrote horrible things. And I'd like to ask you if you've seen any change in that people can just say whatever they want to say, even though they don't know you or have never met you or have never met the person seating next to you or the person in the back. And I'm really interested if you've seen any changes in how that happens in terms of now the universality of cyber electronics.
I think it's gotten worse, actually. And in my case, it was, you know, the thing that really appalled me, it's okay for my students to evaluate me, you know, in the regular evaluations, of course. But other people could do it to me. And when I became the voice of opposition, you know, I said, I'm a gay man, I'm a gay writer. I know about getting free speech. I'm all for free speech. But it's not free speech to go on and say about a math teacher, a woman math teacher, she likes it doggy style. That's a real one. They accused me of having sex with a four-year-old boy in my classroom. You know, and what do you say? You don't even be forced to reply to things like that. No, I didn't. He was five. You know, you're a complete victim of other people's meanness. It's so easy just to sit down at your computer anonymously. I was on the Today Show about this. Thank God Matt Lauer asked me They said, what questions do you want me to ask? And I said, ask me about having a website where you can review teachers you've never had. That's the problem. It's bad enough to have, you know, your friends say nasty things about you, your classmates say nasty things about you. But for people to go on, and people who are evaluating your class don't know whether it's the truth or not. And they say, well, I better stay away from that class. And Dave Wall, who joined me finally at the end of the lawsuit, who was a physics teacher, started getting bad reviews because he stood up for the truth. And people just, they started not enrolling in his class. So you start losing your job. It was horrible. It's still horrible. It's a matter of changing the internet law. I believe it's Section 221 of the Federal Communications Decency Act, which needs to be changed. I don't want everything to be stopped. I say nasty things about people. We should be allowed to do that, but you should not be able to tell lies. You should not be able to defame people. There's one thing to tell the truth. There's one thing to make fun of people. It's a completely different thing to defame and libel people. I think that distinction needs to be made.
So we're coming to that time in our meeting when we were close to closing our program. And I think, Daniel, looking forward, where are you going to go from here? And what would you like to see happen? And let's say the next 5 or 6 years.
I would like to be alive. That's the most I can ask for. I had a knee replacement a couple of years ago. I can walk again. So I'm happy about that. I think the important, it's so cliche, but I think having your health is extremely important. Having sex is important. And having projects. I retired from teaching, but I still write. I don't write every day, but I write to the projects. I have a new publisher, Weiss House of Sweden. I had to publish some of my own books in that period, But what I want mostly is, you know, worldwide fame. In fact, I went to the Oracle of Delphi when I was in Europe, and the Oracle is still working. And she said to you, you will have world fame, Daniel Curzon, but you will be 103 years old.
Thank you so much for joining us tonight at the Commonwealth Club of California for our program, The Big Book in Your Face, Gay Etiquette. With Daniel Curzon, author, teacher, a courageous pioneer against cyberspace electronic gay bullying. Many, many thanks to Daniel and our audience here on the radio and on the internet. And our thanks to Kevin O'Malley, Chair of the Business and Leadership Member-Led Forum. We are also thankful for the support of Ernst & Young, who has been supporting all of the programs during our August program session. I'm Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. This meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than 111 years of enlightened discussion, I want you to know I have not been around for all 111 years, and neither has Daniel. I know that for a fact. But in all of those years of the 100 years of enlightened discussion in the know, this meeting is adjourned. And thank you again for coming.